The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to get started with the final panel of the day, which is a panel on white-collar crime. I'm Randall Eliason. I teach a course on white-collar crime here at the law school, and we're very fortunate to have with us today an excellent panel to talk to you about white-collar criminal issues and current developments in the law and how they might affect the current business climate. Our panelists, first of all, to my immediate right, is Norman Reamer. Norm's the executive director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers here in Washington, which is the leading organization in the U.S. sort of promoting the mission of the nation's criminal defense bar to promote justice and due process in the criminal system. And prior to taking that position, Norm practiced law for 28 years as a criminal defense attorney, and he's also very active in a number of other organizations, including the New York State Bar and the American Bar Association. Next to him, we have Joe Wheatley. Joe is currently working as a trial attorney in the Organized Crime and Racketeering section at the U.S. Department of Justice, one of the famous road warriors over at Maine Justice, traveling all over the country. Prosecuting cases, and as the name of his section implies, organized crime and racketeering, he's involved in the investigation and prosecution of large-scale, complicated criminal enterprises. And then next to Joe, Andy Wise. Andy's a member of the D.C. law firm of Miller & Chevalier, and his practice involves white-collar defense, counseling, and representing individuals and companies, both during trials and investigations on a wide range of criminal, regulatory, and administrative proceedings. Before he went into private practice, Andy worked for a number of years at the Public Defender Service here in the District of Columbia, representing criminal defendants in the local and federal courts here. So we're going to kick things off talking about white-collar crime with Joe from the Department of Justice. Joe, as the person here from the Department of Justice, maybe you can start things off by giving us a little bit of an overview of what you see in terms of DOJ's current criminal enforcement priorities, what changes, if any, you've seen in the last couple of years in light of the financial crisis and the change in administration, and where you think things are going at the Department of Justice.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having us here. I appreciate the name Road Warrior. I didn't know I deserved it, but I like how it sounds, so we'll stick with that. And I appreciate it. I know I don't see any cameras if I could not have my face photographed. I've got some defendants and targets out there that I don't know. I don't want them to know how I look. So with that, I'll get started. Into sort of two parts of my talk. One will be a discussion of the government and its policies, sort of how they've evolved. The second part will be from the perspective of business and how they react to essentially being victimized. The reason I say victimized is that these sort of crimes that I'm going to focus on are primarily targeting financial institutions, and financial institutions have responded to these threats sometimes by working with government investigators to help better investigate the crimes and prosecute them. So first I'll start with the government perspective, particularly focusing upon organized crime, because that's what I work on. Traditionally, the prosecution of organized crime in the United States is focused on the traditional types of organized crime groups, essentially the Cosa Nostra, which is the classic Italian mafia that you see in a lot of movies, and which was the focus of prosecutions from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to the present. It's still very much a threat, and the government's focused on it. However, they're not the only game in town, and other groups are rapidly filling the void that the Cosa Nostra used to occupy almost exclusively. I should say that one of the groups is gangs, such as MS-13, which is establishing a foothold in places like Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, places all over the country. So they're very much a threat, and that's one other prong of the increased pressure by law enforcement. The other side that's also grown is international organized crime groups. The reason why I'm focusing on that is that in April 2008, DOJ released a policy document, received a lot of press, and has kickstarted a lot of initiatives. It's a strategy for targeting international organized crime groups. So this was in April 2008. It was the focus of a speech by the Attorney General. Essentially, it identified a number of threats. The one I'll focus on is threat number 4, which is cyber fraud. You're starting to find a lot of organizations operating out of Eastern Europe, Russia, but elsewhere, including Western Europe, that are very sophisticated. Use people that you were schooled sometimes in the tail end of the Soviet era in some of their engineering and technical schools, very advanced programmers who found themselves out of work after the Cold War when a lot of these institutions started to draw back on their funding. And so they were very quickly recruited by organizations to steal huge amounts of money, primarily from Western Europe, the U.S., and Canada. And they have proven extremely effective at doing so, sometimes $400 million a year in fraud alone, targeting the U.S. and Canada and then the U.K., financial institutions. And the way that they're doing that, you've probably already seen the ways that they commit it. If you've ever gotten an email asking you for your bank account information from Bank of America, but you don't have a Bank of America account, or a Fidelity brokerage account, but you don't have one, well, a couple other million people got that same email that same afternoon. And although you may have deleted or went to your spam, maybe 1-2%, for instance, got that email and responded to it. And that was enough to take sometimes $1 million in an afternoon. It can happen very fast. As quickly as we find these crimes, they sometimes move to new targets, scour those accounts like a plague of locusts. It's very fast, and no matter how many times we find countermeasures, they find someone to infect, to take over their systems, and to take their accounts. But the way it works is pretty straightforward. You get an email, you respond thinking maybe it's a legitimate email. Within minutes, they've sent your contact information around the world. People around the world who are doing jobs without knowing what's going on will go into that bank account and route it quickly to an offshore account, sometimes in very thinly regulated islands, places in Eastern Europe, and you'll wake up and find you have nothing in your account anymore. So business is reacting quickly to this, though, because they're finding that they are often on the hook for making people whole again for these kinds of crimes. Often it's not the consumer that really suffers. It's the bank that, upon discovering that their customer lost all their money, has to make them whole again by putting that money back in their account. This adds up hundreds of millions of dollars a year. We're looking in the billions total. So businesses have an incentive to assist law enforcement to make sure this doesn't happen anymore. So what you're finding are private and public initiatives where they pool resources. The FBI is party to a number of these institutions. What private sector will do, such as a financial institution, if they're finding themselves being victimized, they'll put together a center, basically a clearinghouse for information, where the banks can share information about stolen accounts, about targets that they're finding, and then law enforcement can pull the resources with them to search email accounts, to tap phones, to do arrests, to basically put everything together in one big fusion center so that no lead is unfollowed. So law enforcement and industry are finding that they have mutual interests, and there's been great success. If you look to the media, there have been groups, for instance, the Romanian cyber fraudsters that are being arrested and extradited to the United States for having committed millions of dollars in fraud, sometimes in a given day. I'm going to wrap it up there, so I'll have more time for Q&A at the end.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Norm, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, certainly involved in a lot of white-collar issues that are relevant to the current business climate. Maybe you can give us an overview of what some of your primary initiatives are that you've got going on.
Well, thanks very much. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this. And I, as some of you have noticed, I've been here for since lunchtime, and it's been really an excellent program. So I congratulate the organizers for putting this together. I also want to begin by saying, unlike Joe, I don't care if you photograph me. Those are all potential clients, and so. And also, it's a little bit of an odd juxtaposition because the work that Joe is doing, which he just described, prosecuting the mob, MS-13, and cyber fraud, are not the kinds of concerns that we're going to be addressing today. Those are, for the most part, they are ferreting out criminal activity in a way which we ordinarily expect of our Justice Department. But I'm going to be talking about some other aspects of what we call over-criminalization. To be specifically responsive to the question, though, I will just tell you that my organization, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, is the bar association of the criminal defense bar in this country, and our concerns range throughout the gamut of the criminal justice system. We are not a trade organization in the sense that we advocate for the interests of our members. We advocate primarily for the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments and a little bit of the First and the Eighth as well. And that's what our mission is. And we do it through a whole lot of different means, including education, advocacy, amicus briefs, you name it. We're active in all kinds of reform activities. And I do want to, I have to make this pitch because as the professor pointed out, I've been involved not just with this organization but with other organizations, and all of that as an outgrowth of my almost three decades in practice. I encourage all of you to find a bar association of some kind, whether it's a mainstream bar association, a business bar, a criminal bar, whatever it happens to be. It will enrich your experience tremendously. Bar groups are the engines of reform and ingenuity in our legal system. And I'm not going to divert and do this today, but you can look at virtually every meaningful reform from the creation of the SEC to civil rights movement, and somewhere there was involvement of the organized bar. So that's just my little pitch to you today. I specifically want to talk about what NACDL is doing in what we call our White Collar Crime Project, and our project director, Shanna Regan, is here in the audience today. We are concerned with a phenomenon known as over-criminalization. And it's a concern that stretches across the ideological divide. Our allies in expressing this concern and trying to rein it in range from the ACLU on the left to the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, the Chamber of Commerce, the Families Against Mandatory Minimums. I'm particularly going to talk about white-collar over-criminalization, but over-criminalization is by no means limited to that area, and if I have 2 minutes at the end, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. Look, let's understand something. The history of criminal law is the history of the assertion of government power, and the power to prosecute is the most awesome power that the government exercises towards its own citizens. Over-criminalization is the abuse of that power. And it is a phenomenon that really spans across the three branches of government. It isn't just simply abuse of executive power. It is a dereliction by Congress, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. It is also, to some extent, aided and abetted by the judiciary, and frankly, it's fueled by the media, which latches on to the hysterical problem of the moment and begins the drumbeat for more criminalization, higher penalties, more strict enforcement, and the result is what we have. And I would say that there are four ingredients to this phenomenon. One is the increasing criminalization of conduct. It's mostly on the federal level, but it's increasingly being mimicked on the state level by state attorneys general and state legislatures. And it involves moving into areas that are traditionally left to civil regulation. It also involves the dilution of intent requirements, and I'm going to speak a little bit more focused on that because this is primarily a group of law students and you ought to be interested in the theory of criminal prosecution. It also involves methods that law enforcement uses, and I mentioned that Joe talks about the types of things that they do to sort of catch criminals, but we also have moved into a method of law enforcement in some areas where the government is more proactive in terms of engaging in conduct which, if you know your history, started with the Abscam scandal where you begin to run sting operations and sort of bring people into criminality who might not otherwise be as inclined to do it. And it also involves our penal structure. We have the highest prison population in the world. We have some of the most draconian sentencing practices in this country, although there's been some relaxation of the mandatory guidelines in the last few years. So all of those things combine to create this problem. I want to focus just for the few moments that I have, on two particular aspects of overcriminalization. And the first one is the increasing criminalization of conduct, the unprecedented expansion of federal jurisdiction over behavior that was unthinkable. When I started to practice about 25 to 30 years ago, the criminal dockets in the federal courts were a small percentage of the average judge's docket. You might see an occasional securities case or a bank robbery or something like that with clear federal jurisdiction. Now I think it's completely reversed. Most of the judges are, their dockets are largely criminal. As of 2003, there were over 4,000 criminal offenses in the federal code, and by 2008, that had risen to 4,450. That's a 10% increase in just 5 years. If you add to that the federal regulations, which bring these statutes to life through the regulatory function of government, it has been estimated that there are over 300,000 criminal sanctions available to the government. And this, believe me, is an awesome tool. The threat of prosecution is one of the most potent weapons that the government has, and it can be used, quite frankly, to extract extraordinary concessions from business people who, in the civil context, might actually have an arguable claim that they shouldn't be penalized at all, that they have complied. But the threat of prosecution, both for the individual and for the corporation, is so extraordinary that it is a weapon of unimaginable consequence for those who are trying to do business. And it's something which has been aided by a doctrine known as the doctrine of vicarious corporate criminal liability, which, if you've taken your corporations course, you know that goes back to a case that was decided about 100 years ago in a very different environment. Anybody who's looked at the Arthur Andersen case knows that there are some serious questions as to the viability of that doctrine in this era. Does it make any sense to throw tens of thousands of employees out of work because of the alleged misdeeds of a handful of executives and to penalize shareholders? And, of course, as we know in that case, ultimately the corporation, the case was thrown out, but not until the damage was quite clearly done. So you have this entire motif of overcriminalization, but the most interesting, or one of the most interesting aspects of it, which I really am looking forward to sharing with you, is the dilution of intent. And I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to make the assumption that just about everybody here has at least had the basic criminal law course, and so you know the fundamental concepts of criminal liability. And I'm also going to give you a preview of a report that we will be releasing jointly with the Heritage Foundation within the next few weeks. You all probably know that in order to have a crime, you have to have an actus reus, a bad act, and a mens rea, a guilty mind. The guilty mind requirement is, frankly, the moral underpinning of our law. It's basically the concept that we ought not to punish people unless they knowingly do something wrong. Now, in the common law area, it's pretty easy because we pretty much derive our legal system from the Judeo-Christian traditions. And so things like, you know, killing and stealing and assaulting, you don't really need to have, you don't really need to educate the public about that. Now, I'm not a particularly religious person, but so far as I know, Moses did not get any instruction on regulatory offenses. They didn't talk to him about what to do about honest services, which I know Andy's going to be speaking about, or when trying to help your company and with no personal desire for aggrandizement runs afoul of the criminal code. But what has happened in recent years is Congress is enacting laws without properly putting a mens rea requirement on them, or without putting a high enough mens rea requirement to remain tethered to our moral underpinning. So this report that we have coming out, which is called Without Intent, by the way, How Congress is Undermining the Criminal Intent Requirement, studied the entire 109th Congress. And what we found was that out of 446 new proposed offenses proposed, 57% lacked an adequate mens rea, 23 of which, by the way, were enacted into law. We also found that these laws were being enacted completely bypassing the two committees in the Congress which have the expertise to deal with this, which are the judiciary committees. So you've got criminal laws that are being proposed and enacted without ever being filtered through the judiciary committees. Now, the problem with all of this is that if you don't have an adequate intent requirement, and if you allow courts then to engraft their own construction on it, you have lack of notice, you have lack of fairness, you have situations where the intent requirement may be either lacking entirely or lacking as to certain elements of the offense. And then you get into the question of whether or not you're going to penalize people who are not acting with any kind of specific intent, may not even be acting with any intent, and you get into the dangers of instructions such as what comes with what they call deliberate indifference or willful blindness, and you run the risk that you're going to penalize people for activities for which they really don't have any knowledge that they're committing a crime. I suspect if our preparations have gone well, Andy is going to be talking about some of the areas where this is manifest, particularly in the theft of honest services area. So I would like, hopefully, to have a little discussion with you, if we have time at the end, get your thinking on this, and also talk to you about how this problem, this phenomenon, is not only in the white-collar area, but really is now overwhelming our criminal justice system.
All right. Thank you. I'm actually going to pick up before Andy and talk for a couple minutes about honest services, sort of picking up where Norm left off there, because this is an area, you've got an unusual thing going on this year for people interested in criminal law or interested in white-collar. The Supreme Court has taken cert on three cases this term, all dealing with the same criminal theory. And I don't know if that's unprecedented, but it's got to be close if it isn't. Three cases argued before the Supreme Court this year talking about this honest services fraud theory. And this is irrelevant to business people because a lot of the areas in which this theory has been applied recently has been in the private sector, where corporate executives are charged with defrauding their shareholders of their right to honest services, or employees charged with defrauding their employer of the right to honest services. So this is an area that's been around for a long time. The honest services theory has actually been around for a long time. It's a species of federal mail and wire fraud. And if you've taken a federal criminal law course, you know that federal mail and wire fraud are sort of the bread and butter for federal prosecutors, very broad statutes that can be applied to a huge variety of types of behavior. And all you need is a scheme to defraud someone and then a mailing or a use of the wires in furtherance of that fraud, and you've got a federal felony. Use of the wires nowadays doesn't include just a phone call, but it includes or a landline phone call, but now it includes cell phones, emails, faxes, Twitter, I suppose. I don't know. I don't know if there's been a case yet where someone charged with tweeting in furtherance of a scheme to defraud, but I'm sure that's coming if it hasn't happened yet. So these are kind of the catch-all federal fraud statutes. And most fraud schemes, of course, are to deprive people of money. You've got a scheme to rip somebody off, and you mail a letter. You've got federal mail fraud. Well, honest services fraud developed really way back even before the 70s, but in the 70s it became really popular as a different type of fraud theory, where the charge was that the defendant had defrauded someone of their intangible right to honest services. And there were a number of intangible rights theories that the government developed back at the time. This was one of the leading ones used in the mail and wire fraud statutes, and primarily to go after state and local corruption, because the federal bribery statute doesn't apply usually to state and local officials. So when the federal government, in the sort of post-Watergate era, became more interested in prosecuting state and local corrupt officials, they needed a different theory. And this honest services fraud emerged as sort of a leading one. But it's also used in the private sector, even back then and even more so recently, to charge, for example, employees with defrauding their employer of their right to honest services. What exactly does that mean? The thing is, no one really knows for sure. And that's what's going on with the Supreme Court this term. In 1987, the Supreme Court threw out the honest services theory in a case called McNally and said the mail fraud statute only applies to schemes to deprive people of money or property. It does not apply to this intangible right to honest services. And if Congress wants it to apply to that, Congress has to speak more clearly than it has now. All right? So Congress the next year stuck into a big, huge omnibus drug bill, a little one-line statute, now 18 U.S.C. 1346, that says, okay, we think mail and wire fraud does include the right or a scheme to defraud someone of the right to honest services. And that's all they said. There's no legislative history. There were no debates. It wasn't brought before a committee. So they spoke more clearly, but maybe just barely, by saying, we want this to be included, but they didn't say what they meant. And in the 20-plus years since then, the courts have been kind of struggling with it, trying to figure out what this means, because it can't be literally on its face what it says, because otherwise it makes every act of dishonesty a potential federal crime. This problem even got worse in the wake of the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms in 2002, because mail fraud and wire fraud were increased from a 5-year felony to a 20-year felony. And so now you've got conduct that might just look like an employee violating some kind of workplace rule, or the example everyone used at the Supreme Court this year was employee calling in sick to go to the ballgame. All of a sudden, that's not just potentially a workplace violation where maybe you get fired, but if someone wanted to come along and charge you with that, they could make it into potentially a 20-year felony. Part of the concern in where the business community is concerned about this is simply the breadth of the doctrine and the fear that business executives or employees who make discretionary decisions in the company, what they would consider to be a business judgment, and maybe it goes badly and the company fails or suffers some tremendous damage, that a prosecutor come along after the fact and say, well, they didn't just screw up, they didn't just make a mistake in the line of their ordinary business duties, but they actually defrauded the company and the shareholders of the company's right to honest services. And the difficulty with the doctrine as it currently stands is that the parameters are so uncertain that it's hard to say, you know, when the government could do that and when it couldn't, or to say that it couldn't at all. And that generates a lot of uncertainty in the area of criminal law. So this is a really hot area right now. Two of the three cases before the Supreme Court do involve the private sector. One involves Jeff Skilling, who was the former second or third in command at Enron, who was convicted for, among other things, a number of honest services fraud violations. And he's challenging the doctrine before the Supreme Court and saying that the doctrine should include a requirement that that there was some economic harm or that the employee was acting for a private gain. And he's saying he didn't do that. That's one limitation that's been imposed by some of the lower courts, but was rejected in his case. The other private sector case, Conrad Black, a big newspaper executive with a company called Hollinger. He was convicted of honest services fraud and a number of other charges, and he's arguing before the Supreme Court that there should be read into the statute a requirement that there be some economic harm to the employer, which is another limitation that some courts have read into it and some haven't. So the real question is the Supreme Court going to adopt some of these narrowing limitations and create some additional requirements that aren't in the statute, or are they going to throw the whole thing out and declare it unconstitutionally vague like they did 20 plus years ago in McNally, throw out the whole statute and kick it back to Congress again? And then if that happens, what will Congress do, if anything, in terms of passing the new statute? So that'll be an interesting thing to watch this next few months. They'll decide it presumably by June, and that will have some impact in the business community and in some ongoing cases in particular. And I think Andy can talk about one of those, as he's done one of the leading honest services trials in recent years. He was the trial attorney.
I have a trial set in July of this year on behalf of a gentleman named Kevin Ring. So I'm very eager to see what the Supreme Court does in June, because it could make our trial significantly shorter or significantly more complicated. We will see. But in some ways, that trial itself was a great example of some of the uncertainties that the Supreme Court had talked about with the Honest Services Statute. My client was a lobbyist in D.C. who was 16 years old when the Supreme Court wrote McNally, graduated from law school, joined a lobbying practice. Unfortunately for him, it would turn out that the head of his lobbying practice was Jack Abramoff, who later became somewhat infamous for a number of activities that had little to do with his lobbying but had much to do with his defrauding of clients. But as part of the investigation, the government, the Department of Justice, began to look into the lobbying practices of Abramoff and his folks, and there were some fantastic stories about the types of behaviors that, quite frankly, were not unusual for the way lobbying was practiced in this city. I'm talking about expensive meals, tickets to Wizards games, tickets to sports boxes at the Redskins games. One of the things the government did was they went back and totaled up all the money that Jack Abramoff had spent on tickets to these various events, and it was in the millions of dollars. It was an extraordinary story that trues up a lot of the things that lay jurors and the public views as distasteful about the way our political system works, about the way lobbying was practiced. But Kevin Ring found himself facing 10 felony charges based largely on the allegation that he entertained, at times lavishly, people on the Hill who he then went to seek actions from in their capacity as either representatives or chief of staff to those representatives. It was a case that I think it is fair to say was one that caught many by surprise, that the folks that were doing these things probably had a fairly good sense that they were exploiting gray areas of Senate and House rules that had been passed by Congress and were very permissive in terms of what Congress could accept in terms of entertainment and things like that. But I think it's also fair to say that most of the people that were doing these things had no belief that they were committing federal felonies. The three cases that Professor Eliason talked about really started with Justice Scalia writing a dissent from the court's refusal to take a case from Chicago called Sorich. The court did not grant cert in that case, and Scalia wrote an opinion that essentially said, we need to review this statute. Nobody knows what it means, and it can't be that you learn the crime you're alleged to have committed during your own trial, to which a lot of prosecutors said, this is hyperbolic, this is Justice Scalia going off the deep end. Everybody knows what the core of honest services is and knows how to avoid being prosecuted under this law. In Kevin Ring's case, we debated with the prosecutors and the judge for the 9 months before trial and the 4 weeks of trial about whether or not the government had to prove that Kevin was involved in a material misrepresentation. Because this was a fraud case, one of the things that we were arguing from the start was that the government had to show that there was an effort to conceal the behavior at issue. And in a case where this was dinners at the Capitol Grill and sitting front row at the Verizon Center, it was hard to argue that these guys, whatever they were doing, were trying to hide it from anybody. The day of jury instructions, literally 24 hours before closing, and after 5 weeks of testimony, the government came in and said, we've now changed our position, and we agree that a material misrepresentation is an element of this crime. Now, as the defense lawyer, I was happy to have the government take on another element they had to prove. But the fact that we could be having these discussions during the end of a trial in some ways showed just how vague the statute was. Honest services is going to be probably resolved this spring, and then the question will become whether the court leaves the statute as is, forces Congress to rewrite it, strikes it down. But this is a trend that we are seeing more and more and more in a number of different areas. And another one is a statute that I'm sure many of you have heard of called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It is a statute that essentially prohibits the payment of bribes to foreign officials. That's an oversimplification, but that's essentially what the law is designed to prevent. It was passed in the 70s, and for many years was, I would say, an underutilized tool. DOJ did not prosecute many FCPA cases. I do think there was a view that the DOJ had other interests to really focus on domestic-based and whether some pricing manager for a U.S.-based company was paying a bribe to a port official in Angola was not on the top of DOJ's list of interest. But in the last 10 years, there have been a number of FCPA investigations and movements toward prosecutions. For many years, I would say up until about 3 years ago, there was very little court adjudication of these cases. And if any of you have taken classes on foreign bribery law based, you know, that look at the FCPA, my guess is you haven't read many cases, because there were almost never trials, and these things were almost never challenged, in large part because what DOJ often did was they would go after companies whose employees had been involved in these corrupt activities. And for publicly traded companies, oftentimes, the specter of a criminal indictment was a sufficient threat that there were a lot of resolutions of cases short of trials. In the last couple of years, DOJ has really changed their focus, and is starting to go after individuals. And my guess is that what you're going to see in the next 5 years is a lot of trials. Because now what the government is doing is it's forcing individuals to decide whether they are going to put their own liberty at stake by entering an agreement or whether they're going to try these cases. And I think what you're going to see is more and more trials. Because what you have, I think, in a lot of these cases are situations where criminal liability is being visited upon folks who are fairly high up in the organization, sometimes in the absence of knowledge. And this really is what Norman was talking about before. One of the big FCPA cases in the last couple of years was the prosecution of a guy named Frederick Bork. And it was a case that was tried in New York, and a lot of the discussion was about whether the court could instruct the jury on a theory that is often referred to as willful blindness or deliberate ignorance. Essentially, the defense's contention in the case was, it may well be that somebody that we were affiliated with was paying a bribe in Azerbaijan, but that was not known to me or authorized by me. And the government's theory was that the person should have known. Now, that's a little bit oversimplified, because I think even the most zealous prosecutor would admit that a should have known standard doesn't pass the test of what the government has to prove. But this instruction allows the jury to find knowledge on behalf of the defendant, even in the absence of actual knowledge, if the facts and circumstances would have led a reasonable person to know that criminal conduct was afoot. It is essentially a tool that allows a jury to convict on a negligence standard. And that instruction is being used more and more in white-collar cases, and is the way that prosecutors are trying to get at cases where they are unable to prove actual knowledge on the part of the accused. That trend will lead to more trials, because I think that the Second Circuit, that the judge in Bork was insufficiently clear on what the government has to prove. There's a case in the Second Circuit, there's a case in the Sixth Circuit right now on this instruction, and at some point, I think the courts are really going to have to take a really close look at what the government should have to prove in cases, in part because in white-collar cases, unlike in street crime cases, what you almost always are dealing with are incredibly complex factual scenarios that are being reviewed in situations where something bad has happened. You look at WorldCom, you look at Enron, you look at Global Crossing. These cases all were investigations that were looking back once a bad result was known. And in situations that are very common in white-collar cases where you know the bad result has happened, to put into the mix the ability to use this kind of willful blindness, should-have-known standard is going to be something that I think will be the subject of great litigation.
Okay, we want to try to leave the last 10, 15 minutes or so for questions, comments, insults.
Well, I'd like to, if I can, just
insult.
What this case that Andy was talking about in this whole situation, that sort of illustrates and puts into a really great context what the sort of the whole sequence of events that happens here. You get Congress passing a law which really has a big hole in it, oftentimes reacting to some hysterical event which prompts them to act. And then you have the prosecutor charging in,
And I'm not suggesting bad faith. I'm saying there's a tool available. They believe that something wrong has happened. So they move in. And then ultimately you have the courts sort of abetting this because there is this hole. And then they come up with this instruction, which really is designed to fill that hole. So the absence of a clear intent requirement is substituted with an instruction like willful blindness. And it's something that we have to be concerned about. I mean, I think to the extent that Andy's right, I think trying these cases, if it can happen, and if the government loses a few of them, then they may back off and at least not seek those kinds of broad instructions. But it's an awfully tough price for people to pay to have to try to move the law into a place which is where it should have been in the first place, which is to give people clear notice of what it is that you're not supposed to do so you can comply with the law.
There's one other point, too, about honest service. I mean, if somebody has a question, please, you know, jump up and grab the microphone. But it is worth noting, I think, that it's not usually the case, and actually Andy's trial is almost an exception to this. It's not usually the case that honest services is a standalone charge. In Conrad Black and Skilling, for example, they're charged with many other counts of sort of good old-fashioned money fraud and other obstruction of justice. You know, Conrad Black was going in his office late at night and, you know, turning his back from the security cameras and taking files to his secretary's office. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on, and old money fraud counts as well. And so it's not usually the case that you're walking down the street and the feds are going to swoop in and grab you and charge you with honest services fraud because you called in sick, but you've never done anything else. You know, it's usually it's one of a barrage of charges used in a case where there's a lot of misconduct going on, and much of it is pretty clear misconduct. The government would actually be better off, I would argue, in a lot of these cases if they didn't charge honest services. But what happens is they've got this tool out there, like Norm was saying. They're human. You know, they if it's out there, they feel like they should use it. Prosecutors love alternative theories. They love backup plans, you know, so if this charge doesn't work, I've got something else. And so they go ahead and charge it along with everything else, and then the whole case gets hung up on this definition of honest services. You know, if they had not charged Black and Skilling with honest services, they'd probably have solid convictions right now, and this whole issue would not even be before the Supreme Court. So, you know, prosecutors kind of do it to themselves sometimes. But it is worth pointing out that this is usually one tool that's used in a case where there's a lot of other misconduct going on, and it's not that in most cases that conduct that otherwise is clearly innocent would never be charged, all of a sudden they're swooping in and charging it as honest services fraud. I said Kevin Ring might be closest to an exception to that rule that I can think of.
Most of Kevin's trial was honest services. What made Kevin's case interesting, but it illustrates the professor's point, which is this. There was a lot of stuff that went on with Abramoff's shop, not surprisingly, that was distasteful, that was dishonest. There were rules that governed the value of gifts that could be accepted by congressional staffers. A congressman or their staff was not allowed to accept a gift of more than $50 and that aggregated more than $100 in a year. Those rules were ignored all the time, not only by people in Abramoff's shop, but by lobbyists all over the place. The question with a statute like honest services is the violation of a rule like that, which was administrative in nature, which was enforceable only against the staffers, and which, by the way, was never enforced, should that be the predicate for a federal felony conviction? Because the government's theory in Kevin's case, boiled down, probably oversimplified because they're not here to defend themselves, was essentially that by violating these rules, these lobbyists were doing something they knew was dishonest, and they knew was somehow potentially likely to defraud the voters of the honest services of their elected representatives. So that was, I think, in some ways, kind of an interesting way to put that issue before the jury, because there was no question that there were rules that were violated. But whether that rose to felonious conduct was an issue that we argued about a lot and that our jury split. Some of the folks wanted to convict, some of the folks wanted to acquit. So,
actually, I don't know if you mentioned that part of the history. You had a hung jury in your first trial.
We had a jury that was very responsible, very diligent, worked at it for 8 days, and left exactly divided as they came.
And now the judge has postponed
the new trial date.
Right. We were set to retry the case in June. The judges moved it back for 5 weeks so that we will know, hopefully, what the Supreme Court's going to do, and the parties can adjust accordingly.
Anybody from the – yes. Do you want to grab the mic? Maybe we can hear you. Go ahead.
Well, I was reading about the Black case and the Skilling case, and I read that there's a kind of a radical argument out there against the Honest Services Fraud Statute about how it's just sort of a tool for prosecutors to kind of, you know, use their own, you know, ideas on policy to just come and kind of bring down corporations. What do you guys have an opinion on that argument? Have you heard that argument?
I think I have, and it's been variants of that argument have been part of the discussion. The problem with a vague statute like honest services is that it does allow prosecutions that are unbounded by strict principles, and that's really the role of Congress, is to tell the populace what the law is and what they are and aren't allowed to do. Now, you know, the problem with a statute that is as vague as the Honest Services statute is that it does allow subjective judgments to come into the picture. It allows prosecutions that are easily questioned by the general public. And it allows prosecutors who already have an enormous amount of power, right? Imagine that you are being investigated by the Department of Justice and told that you are suspected of engaging in criminal misconduct. One of your options is to agree to a deal, to agree to testify against others, to cooperate as a witness, and in return the government will seek leniency. Or you can choose to fight it, which, unless you're indigent, could mean literally millions of dollars in legal fees. The prospect for having your name dragged through the press. Part of the problem with a really vague statute like honest services is it gives the prosecutors even more power in those settings, because what you have are folks who are told, look, we know you did something dishonest. And when the statute doesn't really give a lot of clarity as to what is and what isn't illegal, you get situations where people feel an enormous amount of pressure to cut deals. We had in our trial, for example, a staffer who came in and said she had worked on an issue on behalf of a congressman that she worked for 20 years. About 17 years into it, she was approached by these lobbyists and was lobbied, and she said, look, everything I did for these guys, essentially, I would have done anyway. They were representing a constituent that I felt very strongly about, but they also were willing to give me tickets and take me out to meals, and so I was absolutely happy to take them. It didn't change anything I did, but I knew I shouldn't have taken them. I hadn't reported them on my taxes. And so instead of facing the prospect of paying a lot of money, I, you know, cut a deal. Now, does that mean that it was a prosecutor that was abusing the statute to push a personal vendetta? No, not in this situation. So I'm not sure I would go necessarily as far as the proponent of the argument that you suggest, but I do think the vagueness inherent in the statute allows for a lot of abuses and allows for a lot of second guessing.
Hi, I would like to thank all the panelists for such an engaging presentation. My question is directed towards Mr. Wheatley, and as a DOJ attorney...
It's not about honest services fraud, is it?
No. As a DOJ attorney, I was personally curious to know what your response would be to Mr. Reimer's presentation that we're going a little bit too far in our prosecution and what we see as criminalized conduct.
Measure my words on this. It's very thought-provoking, and I think he's raising very important issues. It is staggering how many federal crimes there are, really quite staggering. In my daily work, I only use a handful of them, and I'd have to say that the ones I deal with are not of sort of the regulatory nature. We use the racketeer influencing corrupt organization statute, RICO statute, which has been used go after the mafia and gangs and things like that. And there's a lot of settled law on those statutes. You know, mail fraud, wire fraud, those have been around for years. It's the ones that, you know, emerge sort of out of the ether. And, you know, no one really remembers them being passed, and all of a sudden you see them in an indictment. Geez, I don't remember taking a class on that one. I remember, you know, going to the NAC, which is the National Advocacy Center, which is sort of the training school for prosecutors, and hearing about that statute. You know, I think there is a risk when statutes don't go through the traditional process for being vetted, so that you can have people who have used statutes before and see, well, what are the pitfalls here? Is it ample notice to someone so that you don't run the risk of, for instance, criminalizing something that's just lousy behavior as opposed to criminal behavior? You know, some of the criticism you hear about things like honest services fraud is that you're criminalizing someone's being a lousy politician or a lousy businessman, where instead you're supposed to punish things that are criminally bad, that it rises to some sort of moral outrage or an understanding by the community of something that's wrong, as opposed to just being lousy.
Yeah. Okay, just to piggyback over what seems to be a consensus on a panel, why won't the DOJ speak up about the statutory provisions that may be vague? Because if you have the DOJ enforcing many of these statutes in the name of justice, in the true spirit of justice, does it make sense to indict persons who, in the spirit of the statute, really aren't guilty, and instead really go after people who, you know, maybe issue, I don't know, a letter, something, you know, just issues a statement stating that this is, because I'm thinking as far as administrative law, you have agencies who are authorized to issue rulings and regulations based on statutes. The DOJ, I mean, I just get a sense that maybe they would have something to say about, you know, the honest.
They do have something to say. I mean, they filed a lot of things in response to these appeals. I should say that I will not comment on any pending cases. I recognize the risk in over-criminalization. I absolutely recognize, but I can't comment on that.
If you looked at the Solicitor General's arguments in these Supreme Court cases that we just had, I mean, basically they don't agree that it's as vague as many of the defense side of the bar view it. They say there's sort of a core of cases that have always been understood to be honest services violation. That core is clear enough, and they know they just have a different view on sort of the breadth of the statute and whether it's really being abused or not. They see it as a useful tool, and it is a useful tool for them, and I think they're going to try to preserve it. That's in their institutional interest if they can do that.
Can I make just one comment about that? And you know, I haven't spent my career defending the Department of Justice. But I am a defense lawyer, and you have to understand that the way our system works and is supposed to work is that the Department of Justice is supposed to enforce and defend the laws that Congress enacts, the President signs into law. So it's not like, you can talk to solicitors general both, well, you can't talk to current ones about very much, but you can talk to past ones, and they will say, look, my duty is to defend the law as Congress has enacted it. So it's really up to us as litigators, us as reformers, us as academics, and us as students really going out into the profession to tackle these problems and change the law and bring clarity to it.
And I actually think that it's interesting because I think your question in some ways encapsulates what this debate is about. I think the Department of Justice would say exactly what these folks have said, that we think this statute is sufficiently clear. And one of their arguments would be that the kind of conduct we're prosecuting certainly violates the spirit of that law. What the defendants often rebut is it may violate the spirit, but how do you define the spirit of the law if it's not articulated in the law? And so the laws really are supposed to set out prohibited conduct, not some sense of what is right or wrong. And that's really, in some ways, what this has come down to. During the arguments, Justice Scalia has said a couple of times, because the government's response often is, look, we know that this conduct fits within the core of honest services. Scalia has often said, look, we could pass a law that says, do no wrong. And everybody would agree that murder is wrong and would be covered under that statute. That doesn't make that statute sufficiently clear to give proper notice for a criminal prohibition. That's why we love Scalia.
Oh, yeah, he's such a friend of the defense bar, normally. Yeah.
I have to say, as a former public defender, I never thought I would be so fond of Antonin Scalia. But.
Well, we should probably wrap up and continue over cocktails or something, right? Anything else?
Thank you very much.